Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
But this is Jeffrey Rosenheck, and he's giving an interview where he's talking about this letter where he's demanding an apology of the former president, black male of the University of Albany. It's like 60 seconds.
You're a senior at this school. You've been here for 4 years, I imagine. Probably seen a lot of demonstrations about race relations and things like that. Does the fact that these three girls came out and reported this falsely hurt this cause of, you know, trying to close the gap on racial relations and making sure that, you know, we do address this problem?
Well, I specifically don't want to comment about race in this instance because my letter was not about it. It's about the fact that our president did not give any of these students due process. There was no fair trial, and he took these girls' word for it that it actually happened, and we're finding out it didn't. So it's not fair at all.
What would you like to see next?
I would personally, now with these charges being brought against these girls, I would like to see a formal apology saying that he was rash in his decision to send out an email saying that these students actually did this.
Context of white supremacy. I really want to get your thoughts on white victimization, but I want to give you an opportunity. Anything you want to say in response to that clip?
Just use your judgment. This guy, he's a teenage, white, cis, heteronormative male. Like, this is, his view is always presented out here. And why is the news interviewing this random student for a letter he wrote? Why aren't they interviewing some of the people closer to the case? Why aren't they interviewing black women on campus? Why aren't they interviewing Professor Dr. Chandler, who's a university professor who actually came out in support of the women? Why aren't they interviewing people that matter? Instead, they go right from the typical white male perspective of the prosecution and the law enforcement and the university, and they just find the first white male student who says something, and suddenly he's given airtime. He's getting an interview on the news. I know there are tons of black liberation movements in this area who were working to defend those women, and they weren't reached out to speak to the media. So the media was very calculated in what they chose to present, and that's part of the reason that this documentary was done independently, because we wanted to express that. We wanted to offer a counter-narrative.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Monday, February 27th, 2017. So I have been told it snowed again today. I have lost count of how many times it has snowed. We are not accustomed to this much snow in this part of Washington State. Hopefully, winter of 2007 will conclude succinctly. That said, we soldier on. Folks, remember, we've been talking about this case for a year. We caught it when everything first happened, the UAlbany 3 case back in 2016. This was three black female students. They were on a bus. It was a Saturday evening, and there were some drunk white students, white women, white men on the back of the bus. They made some rude comments. This whole confrontation ensued. The black female students, they called 911. They reported that they had been attacked, that they had been called racist names and physically attacked by these drunken white hooligans on the bus. We talked about it on the program. We played some of the different news reports. A few weeks after the initial reports, everything changed. They released some edited pieces of video footage and said, well, wait a minute. Things were not reported accurately the first time around. In fact, the black females, they're the instigators, and we're going to charge them with filing a false report and assault and everything else. And so the case kind of evolved from there. There was a documentary film that came out last year talking about this case and pointing out what I think are some of the really important elements of how racism, white supremacy operated from the initial incident all the way through, with how the University of Albany dealt with the incident, how the enforcement officials dealt with the incident, the media, how the press covered this incident. Great film. It's online. We had some of the filmmakers on with us back right at the end of November of 2016 to talk about the film, and they encouraged us to follow the case, that two of the black females in this case, they have court cases pending, and that other people at the University of Albany have been connected and advocating for this case. One of the folks that they encouraged us to speak with joining us for this evening, she is a professor at the University of Albany. I looked at her faculty page, and I'll just read exactly what it said. I said, wow, how interesting. So her research interests, it says, pathological culture and thought in European systems, resistance against racism, white supremacy, and it's got the slash and everything, racism, white supremacy, understanding the impacts of racism, white supremacy on Pan-African identity. I said, wow, how interesting. This will be fascinating to have her on the program, hear some of her views on racism, and then specifically her area of interest, how it's revealed in this particular case. Joining us live this evening, Dr. Daphne R. Chandler. Dr. Chandler, you're with us?
I'm with you. Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to speak with you, Mr. Renegade.
Pleasure is ours. We are delighted you could spare some of your time. For folks, I'm sure for some people, this is their first time hearing about who you are and the work that you do. Anything you think would be important for listeners to know about your work?
Yes, and thank you for that opportunity to share that. Just really quickly, because I do want to jump right into this issue, this topic, because it's ongoing, the next court date, and that is before the Albany grand jury is next month, pretty much April. There's no date yet, as far as I know, but it's in April. It's fast approaching, and so we do want to, as much as possible, spread very informed, balanced, and, you know, just information about this case against these now two UAlbany black female students. Before we jump into it, though, I would just like to share my chosen name, and that's my cultural name. That's Amani Shaketi Ani. Dr. Ani, if you could say that. Amani Shaketi Ani. If you were to Google me, for instance, you would find probably at this point more publications and information in terms of the work that I do under that name, Amani Shaketi Ani.
Absolutely. We will say that moving forward. Mm-hmm. Dr. Amani Shaketi Ani. Ani. Mm-hmm. Dr. Ani.
Dr. Ani. Sister Amani. Either one works.
Outstanding. I think it should be obvious, but for folks who haven't seen you, you are a black female. Is that correct?
That is correct.
This program, I use the term racism and white supremacy, seemingly maybe the way that you do, connecting them, that they mean the same thing.
That's correct. That's correct.
I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use, a global system of people who classify themselves as white, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. are dedicated to abusing and mm-hmm. or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify
correct.
As not white. Well, she beat us to the
punch. Everyone and everything. People, places, all matter. Right, and unseen. Absolutely. It's a very serious issue that we have to battle with today.
Right on. What definition mm-hmm. do you use with your students in your classes for racism, white supremacy?
You know, absolutely. One of the ways that I help my students to quickly grasp the context of what we're dealing with is I use a strategy of really tapping into the language that they use every day. And for me, you know, if I were just talking to a colleague or someone who was very, you know, we could say well-read, who was familiar with Neely Fuller, our now ancestor, Francis Cress Welding, Dr. Welding, who for me was my first introduction to the nomenclature, right? That there is a codification of racism. There are words, there are terms, there are systems in place that work together, that are connected to oppress the masses of the people on the planet. And again, we're talking also now at this point, land, air, seas, you know, all people, all things in existence to be subordinated under this privileged racial and ethnic class coming out of Europe, Russia, Europe. That's the sort of the longer definition and detailed information. But really our students, our young people, everyday folk understand racism, white supremacy every time they say the system, institutionalized racism, mass incarceration, these things that they talk about all the time. I really strive to help them understand that it's real, you know, and racism is not this sort of thing that exists somewhere out there in space in the ecosphere that you can't touch or see. No, it operates through people, the decisions they make, the systems that they erect to contain us in the society.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is amazing. In your coursework, because I guess for me, it's mm-hmm. it's a little bit surprising to see one be that explicit from the academy in terms mm-hmm. of this is my research and this is my view on racism. A lot of times it will be greatly diluted. It'll be white privilege or social justice. It'll be terms that are much more vague, much less accurate in terms of describing this problem. I guess, yeah, did you have any resistance? Have you had problems? I mean, just making it that plain?
You know, not really, because I come out the gate with that day one. You know, that's what's on the board. We're having real, as they say, real talk and keeping it 100, right? 100 around what these very real issues are. And it's critical because as long as we have these sort of amorphous, intangible conversations around racism, white supremacy, we're not going to resolve anything. We're going to go about our daily lives, going to classes, going to work, not really aware, consciously aware every moment of who our enemies are and who our actual real allies, as we say, family, are. You know, we have to be able to point to people and to concrete things, words, terms, you know, ways of communicating both verbally and non-verbally. We have to be able to, you know, immediately recognize what those things are. And that's a part of what happened with these young women. They understood quite clearly. You know, they didn't have to hear a racial slur, you know. They didn't have to hear the quote-unquote N-word, have to be called a nigger, for them to know that, you know, they were under assault, under threat. And a part of that is that spoke and speaks to me about their level of consciousness and their awareness and really how they were raised, you know, their intelligence. To recognize when you are being assaulted, because violence happens on multiple levels. And that's, you know, that's a part of when we live in a system where racism, white supremacy is normalized because of how we talk about it or talk around it. Then, you know, most of us might shake something off or look beyond it, downplay it, minimize it, et cetera. Whereas those of us who are consciously aware of what we're dealing with, are a lot faster to recognize, hey, that's not okay. That's a violation. You know, the way you looked at me, the way you spoke to someone else with regard to me, all of these things, you know, they become very clear to you when you understand how racism and white supremacy works and that it's not something that, again, is amorphous and sort of, you know, only happens in certain pockets of society. Versus all around
it. I definitely want to get to the case. Just what exactly is on the syllabus? What exactly do you teach in your research with pathological culture and thought in European systems?
Okay. Well, you know what? Let's start from the top, I suppose. My graduate course, I teach race theory and social thought at the graduate level. And one of the things that I try to make my students at, again, the graduate level and the undergraduate level, very clear about from the beginning is our problems, you might say, black problems, black issues, black culture, black social condition versus those of other people. And that's important because we often make the mistake of making someone else's history, their definitions of who we are, our culture, our history, our own, and vice versa. In other words, racism, white supremacy, is a white problem, not a black problem. We are on the receiving end of it. We have to deal with, on a very visceral level, and across genomics, you know, the mind, which is the most important, and the body, health, education, all of these factors. We have to deal with the ramifications of racism, white supremacy, but it does not stem from us. So the very first lesson in my classes, and particularly at the master's level in this course, Race Theory and Social Thought, is to understand who the arbiters, who the conveyors of racism, white supremacy are, what their culture are or have been coming out of Russia. One of the very first texts that we delve into in this course is Horstmann's text. And is it on my desk? I'm going to have to now pull up this text for you. And it deals with Anglo-Saxonism, right? It deals with the beginning of the so-called, the creation of the New World and who the people were that came over and so-called discovered America and, you know, the Caribbean islands and named the Indians who weren't called, who didn't call themselves Indians at that time. Who these people were and what it was about their culture, their ways of thinking, their worldviews that really gave birth to who we now identify sort of collectively as white. So I'm going to pull up the name of that book.
Oh, we are waiting. With bated breath, we are waiting. Like, okay, come
excellent.
On.
It's the title of the text that we use is Race and Manifest Destiny, Reginald Horstmann. And it's important to allow, you know, Europeans to have to take responsibility, you know, over and to essentially give them credit for what is theirs. And racism, white supremacy is one of those things. It's not a positive thing, but it's theirs. You know, our ancestor, Kwame Ture, or Stokely Carmichael, was very accurate in stating that, you know, back in the 60s, that we don't have a civil rights problem, right? And many of our ancestors have said this. James Baldwin, this is a common understanding that when you really stop and think about it, you know, as much as we march and protest and are constantly fighting these battles, this is not my issue. And we can't lose sight of that, because the second you lose sight of that, then you start to question everything, right? Maybe I am a problem. Maybe my culture is the issue. Maybe I don't have a culture. Maybe the way I look, the way I talk is a problem, and I need to change how I dress or how I speak to be accepted, to be respected. So it's critical, you know, at the outset to separate who is responsible for this issue. So Race and Manifest Destiny, Reginald Horstmann, is a historical and anthropological text studying, you know, the Nordic the proto, if you will, Proto-Indo-Europeans, in other words, the Europeans, again, who some 6,000 years ago came out of the Caucasus Mountains, that region, came out of the Russian steppe and slowly migrated throughout Europe and across the rest of the world under this onus, this thinking of being this, you know, superior race and being these conquerors. So it's a very troublesome history if you're black or just non-white, but it's critical that we know it, and we too often don't.
Absolutely. Context of white supremacy. I just got my copy of Race
Excellent.
And Manifest
Excellent.
Destiny. We
How
might
exciting.
Have to add that to our book club if folks
Please
are...
do.
Are interested. We can ride with that on the next one. Thank you so much for indulging us. Now we can get to a current day example of that pathological culture and thought in European behavior. So the incident with the UAlbany 3 that started, I guess, last January of 2016, the incident first happens, it's reported that they've been racially attacked on this bus incident. Lots of people are upset. They end up having a rally on the campus. Did you participate in the rally?
I was present, and I advised the young sisters who worked to put it together very quickly. From Saturday evening, that morning of, that the tweets, the very social media messages were sent out, that Monday morning, you know, the campus was abuzz. The Black community on campus was abuzz. Particularly, I have to shout out the young sisters in the National Congress of Black Women, NCBW, and their advisor, their faculty advisor, Sister Amberly Carter. You know, they were up in arms and ready to be on the front lines immediately and kind of tapped me, as they often do, for counsel, advising around which way to go with the programming.
Wow. The rally ended up becoming very important because after... Yes. The enforcement officials decided that, oh, wait a minute, we're going to charge these young ladies with a crime and say that they fabricated this allegation and charge them with assault. Part of the indictment, it said that they wasted time and energy with this false report, and part of it was this rally. They conducted this rally to further promote their, I guess, lies about this incident. I think that's pretty much the way the indictment is phrased. I know we talked about this before, this notion that they were being punished because, and they, just to make sure it's clear, the young ladies, they did not, like, sponsor this rally. It was not their idea. They weren't the ones that came up with this. This was all independently done just to support and larger incidents of racism. It was even beyond just this one incident with these young three ladies. But the idea that just Black people showing any self-respect, any effort to fight back against racism, white supremacy must be annihilated. Even this rally where hundreds of people turned out.
Correct. Well, you know, you touched on a very important point, and that is sort of what is the university's issue with there having been a march? Even if it were the case that, you know, they had known at that time that they would wind up turning around and charging the three young women with supposedly, allegedly false reporting of a crime, what, right? Here you have an act of, as you said, students, faculty, staff, and community members, people from the community, from, you know, unaffiliated UAlbany community members across the capital region and beyond, in fact, came to this campus really in support of a very righteous cause, and that is justice, right? Justice, period. Justice anywhere, everywhere, and for everyone. So no harm, no foul, right? Either way you go, this is... a learning opportunity. It's a healing conversation, and it's a positive. However, that being said, the issue was not so much the march or the purpose for it. It was the bad publicity, right? It was the fact that the university system, the SUNY system, and particularly its flagship institution, UAlbany, was in the hot seat and under the gun in the public eye, in the media, for, you know, what has become taboo, at least in rhetoric, right? And that's racism, white supremacy. That is, you know, hate crimes against Black people, any non-white people, any group, you know, because of their race or ethnicity, right? And then, of course, tack onto that, these were women. So this was not a positive thing, that old saying, you know, all press is good press. All publicity is good publicity. Not the case here, right? Not when you want to maintain an image of being an institution of higher learning. So the issue was, how dare you, point a finger at this institution and potentially threaten our recruitment, threaten our endowment, threaten our money, right? Because all of those things are connected to an institution's image. When that begins to go down, then so do the dollars. And so that's where the real issue seems to have been, because otherwise, you know, it is, again, hey, you all did a great thing. And we appreciate the fact that, you know, this campus and surrounding community members are willing to immediately jump into action around a good cause. Why is that not the message?
Absolutely. Absolutely. What you talk about the university's response to this case, and for folks, if you want to get research or if you've just forgotten the three young black females in this case, Alexis Briggs, Arielle Agudio, and Aisha Burwell. Arielle Agudio and Aisha Burwell, those two young ladies, their case is still pending. That's the one where we're talking in April. There's not a specific date. Once I find out, I'll let you all know, and we'll make sure to update. Mm-hmm. But their two cases are still pending. You talked about the university's response in this case. At the time, even though he stepped down now, but at the time, the President Jones, was a black male who was at the helm and doing a lot of the press conferences and what have you to deal with this incident. What did you make of his conduct during all of this?
Well, of course, you know, he did what he was supposed to do. And I must say that I'm impressed with his post sort of media response, the clip that you played before introducing me, of this young white male demanding an apology from the president for his initial reaction. And which was one of supporting justice, not any particular group over another, or any particular issue, you know, be it a sex crime or a race crime, you know, an abuse of one's religious choice, etc. But literally, we don't condone this behavior. We want to make that clear and known, period, right? That's important to say because the president did not, in that initial response of his, the email that went out to the campus, he did not indict anyone. He did not mention any student's name in terms of the 35 or so students who were white and on the bus. He did not incriminate anyone in his response. What he did was stand on principles, and he stated where the university stands in terms of its mission and its expectations for students, for faculty, for staff, et cetera, in terms of treating one another. That is not an issue, right? Racism, white supremacy is exactly a part of the issue in terms of something like that. The fact that he's a black male, you know, with the audacity to release such a statement in support of three female students who are also black and, you know, giving statements that, as he said later on, I had no reason to question at that time. And as we'll talk about the details here, still don't have any reason to question and not rally in support or, you know, say what really this nation should be about, period, at this time, 2017. There's, you know, nothing wrong with this coming out and saying, here's where this university stands, and I, as a president, am going to enforce these expectations loud and clear and proudly. I had no issue with President Jones's response immediately after or later on, whenever he was sort of coming under attack. I do, however, I've said then, and I will say now, that, you know, the statement's great. An email, a letter, great. But what's even better is being present and vocal and, you know, in the flesh, on the front lines, where students are having a march, a rally, and, you know, on a matter of principle, not because you necessarily agree with everything stated or everyone, you know, slated to speak, but because the issues and what's at stake is much bigger than any one of them. So I do feel like he was, you know, his absence was sorely felt, and students made that clear then in terms of his even questioning and having, you know, something to say about these charges. And the fact that no one to this day, unless you are closely following the case, can name one white student on the bus. But you know the three young African Americans, you know, that's a problem. Because we know, if nothing else, that there wasn't a physical altercation that requires, you know, two parties, two sides, if you will. And so there's still so much left unsaid and so much worth questioning that, you know, it is it's pretty sad and shameful that we didn't hear anything from him, or for that matter, anyone else in leadership, after criminal charges were filed against these three young women, Asha and Ariel and Alexa.
Context of white supremacy. You've been a vocal advocate on their behalf, I guess, for about a year now, since this incident came out, kind of connected to former President Jones, Robert Jones. It might be connected to his conduct in the case, why he was not more present physically to support what was happening in all of this. Maybe not. But my question, did you personally, Dr. Ani, encounter any problems or mistreatment, any difficulties because of your personal support of these young ladies?
You know, nothing that was for me worth, I guess, making a fuss about or crying out about. There were some incidences on campus. My window, my office window was broken out that semester. You know, racially charged, very clearly, you know, white supremacist flyers were placed around campus, two of them on my window. I don't know, and it may be a part of how I operate. I don't know that I was necessarily singled out. You know, most of my issues at this campus really has been at the level of leadership, who don't appreciate my being vocal and sort of further, giving wind, and helping to blow the flames in terms of what's really happening here. And I talk about it as a culture of cover-up, because there's a lot that happens with regard to the UPD on this campus, that students, you know, when they trust you, that they will be vocal about and they'll share. You know, they'll file complaints. A lot happens with regard to, you know, the distribution of funds, for instance, for support of certain activities and organizations and those sorts of things. Those are systemic and institutional. And I, as a black professor on this campus, am a part of, you know, multiple communities. That's where we are. I'm not just a professor here. I'm a black female professor in African studies, and that sets me apart in a way, you know, that it naturally would in a system that is still not yet, and perhaps never will be, actually integrated. So I think the issues that I face here are more systemic and not per se with regard to, you know, my being vocal about this case, but just the general culture here at UAlbany and perhaps citywide.
Wow, that pathological culture and thought in European behavior on display again. The two young ladies that are still have cases pending, Ms. Agudio, she faces one count of assault, three counts of attempted assault, three counts of false reporting, and three counts of harassment. Ms. Burwell is charged with one count of assault, four counts of false reporting, and one count of harassment. This is the case where we've got a date in April coming up. Catherine K. Russell, she wrote the book The Color of Crime, Racial Hoaxes, White Fear, Black Protectionism, Police Harassment, and Other Macroaggressions. She talks about a lot of different incidents, some that we've talked about a lot on this program, Charles Stewart, Sharon Smith, Tawana Brawley, some of the infamous cases dealing with racism, and particularly cases where white people have alleged that a black person harmed them or did something to them, and then it turns out that that did not happen. Two of the key points that she includes in the book, she says, one, the public appears to be more willing to believe someone white who says they were victimized by someone black than someone black who says they were victimized by someone white. She goes on, she says, black hoax perpetrators are more likely to be charged with filing a false report, which is what happened in this case, than white hoax perpetrators. I thought that whole book is relevant to this case just for a lot of reasons, not saying that they made up anything, just A lot of what she talks about in that book definitely applies with this case. Just a lot of that seems to be very, very blatant, that they were not these black females, that they were not believed up front. And then it seemed almost, I would almost say, like a joy that, oh, see, they lied. They made all this up.
Sure.
From the beginning, it even reminded me of the film Spinning into Butter, which I see people reference on a regular basis. I don't know if you're familiar, but it very much gave that tone of an enjoyment. This confirms exactly what we thought in the first place. Black people are always lying about racism.
Correct. Absolutely. And, you know, it's a shame. I sent shortly after we on the campus, and that's the other thing, none of us even knew that charges were being initiated by, and here's the thing, UPD. And people don't know this, but literally the university was behind the charges being filed against the three women, Asha, Ariel, and Alexis, not any of the so-called victims on the bus, who they aggressively, for no apparent reason, you know, attack. And that's critical because, one, in terms of the alleging of a crime, you think about this situation, this night on the bus, the fact that about 7 to 9 911 calls being made, all of them were made by one of the three girls, Asha, Alexis, or Ariel. Not one single European student, white student on this bus called 911. And when you think about on a historical level, in terms of the context of, especially right now, in the past 2 or 3 years, with police brutality being on, you know, headline news across the country and the world right now, in terms of state-sanctioned violence against people of color and primarily African-Americans, What are the chances? What would be the benefit of the three young African American students calling the police versus one of these, you know, 30 plus white students who have historically had the law and police on their side? Right, it makes no sense. Why these girls would call 911 versus none of them? Again, not one 911 call, no competing allegations or sense of being victimized or under attack, unsafe, hurt. You know, if you were attacked, you would be angry and ready to call and file charges on someone, right? And so, when you put this sort of in historical context, it literally does not make sense in terms of these three young black women having made false allegations, false charges, knowing that, you know, in this climate, they may be putting themselves at higher risk in terms of either being, you know, the ones to be seen as the aggressors or literally not receiving any help or any assistance at all or being believed at all. When the news of the charges initially broke, I literally sent colleagues and certain leadership on campus a list of particularly white women who we know, okay, wound up making false reports against usually white men, or I'm sorry, black men, sometimes black women as well, for having kidnapped their kids or raped them or robbed them, only to later find out that it was something that they themselves had done or someone they knew had done, or they didn't know who had done it, but it was just convenient to bring a black person because they know as well as we know that this system is designed and built for their protection and service and not ours.
Absolutely. When I'm sure in the book that I referenced, The Color of Crime, she mentioned some of the very cases that you shared.
Right.
And it's even been updated because, I mean, these are happening all. It was one last week where two white hunters, they went out and shot each other and just decided that they were going to blame it on some illegal aliens.
Wow.
And they did file charges.
Wow.
For them making a false report. But I mean, this is all the time.
Good.
And the thing that I've said is that for me, number one, this to me glaringly shows that white people are not ignorant about racism. You cannot keep pulling this sort of fabrication and getting away with it, or even having people continue to be willing to try this if they don't understand racism and the general anti-black perception that this system creates. Mm-hmm. That's one. The other thing I think is, man, if these are the ones that, you know, we catch, right? Bonnie Sweden, where she said some black person stole her car with her child and all that. There have to be tons of these that do not get caught, where the white person succeeds. They just blame something on a black person or a group of black people and they just get away with that everything, you know, the whole prison system, that's a whole nother conversation. There's a sound clip. This is one of the really standout pieces of audio. This is from the court case from last year during the arraignment with all of this. And I believe all three young ladies were present at this court case. This is in the springtime. They went, and the white female judge, I want to ask a specific question about the role of white women, because they were so heavily, they've been so heavily involved in this case from the very beginning, and I feel like they often get left out. But this is from the court, the arraignment from last year, and I want folks to pay particular attention to the language that the white female judge uses when she's talking to these young ladies. This is Context of White Supremacy. We'll be right back with Dr. Ani. This is like a 30-second clip.
Attack on the bus.
Emma Cloy breaks it all down. She joins us now with more. Anne?
Liz, Greg, today we learned in addition to a male student, one of the women is now charged with having physical contact with two other passengers during that violent bus ride.
Arielle Agudio, Aisha Burwell, and Alexis Briggs faced a firestorm of media as they walked into court to be arraigned this morning. None of the women, each accused of assault in this incident on a CDTA bus January 30th, would stop to answer questions and stayed quiet throughout the hearing, their lawyers all entering pleas of not guilty.
If proven, those charges do have a profound impact on our community. In fact, if proven, they're shameful.
Today, the Albany County District Attorney announced additional charges of harassment for both Burwell and Agudio. Agudio now facing a total of 6 charges, Burwell, 3. The DA also announced altogether, arguing the defense hasn't been given all the evidence against the women, including victim statements and cell phone video.
We don't have them, and I think they should be provided to us promptly.
The motion was denied, the judge saying she wants this case to move through the court system as quickly as possible.
This case really has already done enough damage in our community. It's like an open wound, and I want it resolved.
And today we learned Burwell has moved home to Long Island with her parents and is no longer a student at UAlbany. Agudio and Briggs are still enrolled in school and are allowed to keep their jobs while under supervision.
Context of white supremacy. Before I get to the white women specifically, just the language that was used where she says that this case has already done enough damage to our community. Whose community do you think she was talking about that was damaged from this incident?
Well, certainly, you know, the same community that the police were referring to when in their the transcriptions, when they were released of their questioning, literally supposed to be investigating these statements by the three young women, are saying to these white students that, you know, don't worry, you're not in any trouble. And we're going to quell all racial tones in terms of their statements and this being a hate crime. You know, we're going to protect, you know, our people, our community. You know, we're not going to, this is not going to be a part of this case if we can help it. Literally, they're talking about the same community as this judge is. And yes, quite clearly, it's not about the entire Albany community, which is a diverse community, but she's referring to those who are, you know, rightfully recognized as American, and that's European, right? Everyone else requires a hyphen. You know, you're African American, Chinese American, Asian, you know, not American as they are, right? They're not European American, they're American. So the community she's referring to, quite obviously, is those who are supposedly now the victims of these false allegations, and that's this bus full of white students.
Wow. Most of whom were inebriated. Mm-hmm.
Pathology of white culture, that alcohol. specifically with the white women, and I think, I mean, just in my opinion, it's so important because I think a lot of times when we talk about racism, white supremacy, it gets focused on the man. And a lot of times that people are talking about problems with policing, a lot of the officers that they're talking about, it's white males, where just in my view, a lot of times to our detriment, we leave out the hugely important role that white women play in maintaining this system. Just in this case, since it started with these drunk white women on the bus, and then now we have a white woman on the bench who is shaking her finger at these three young ladies and saying that you wounded our community. Just can you talk about the role of white women?
Absolutely. I'm so, you know, loving your thought process here because you're being very thorough, and I appreciate that. I am. It's unpublished, but I've completed, just as of, I believe, December, an article titled "To the Mothers of Whiteness," for the very same reason that you're touching on. And I make the point in the introduction that all too often, racism and white supremacy is seen as a white male issue. And we lose sight of the fact that these white men, who certainly are often out of control, acting as barbarians, right? Coming out of the Caucasus Mountains, the caves and hillsides of Russia. They sort of wear this machismo, macho, you know, bravado type of aggression as a suit of armor. And, you know, this entire culture, you see it throughout in terms of how football, even the sports that are, you know, football is the sort of, you know, it's a craze, right? The Super Bowl and the police force, the military, all of the things that sort of run and govern this country are these forceful, aggressive, you know, tools. And this is true, but we often, and to our own detriment, lose sight of the fact that these men are married to white women, are birthed by white women, have white sisters, have white cousins, you know, et cetera, aunts and grandmothers. And we have to begin to implore the entire white community, that their family structures, to take responsibility and to, you know, look at themselves in the mirror, if you will, in terms of understanding their issues of racism, white supremacy, because it is not just a white male issue. It can't be, because they don't exist in a vacuum. You know, they're raised in a culture and in a family and a community as much as the rest of us are. And we have to begin to indict white women as much as we do white men if we wish to resolve it.
When is To the Mothers of White Men, when is that going to be published?
You know, it's supposed to be published, all the publishing world, there's always a lag. You can look for it, I would say, in May, by May, April or May. But I'm happy to send it to you, Beth. I will send it to you.
Oh, bless you.
Tonight. I will. I certainly will.
Awesome.
You know, she's an example. She's an example of exactly what we're talking about right now in terms of her being this really sort of, you know, meek, you know, duplicitous, you know, sort of quiet, but all, you know, the more lethal for those reasons. Arbiter and perpetuator of racism, white supremacy, as she sits there, as you said, with her gavel and her soft voice and her, right, looking like a soccer mom, your suburban, you know, ordinary, you know, just good old, you know, taxpaying American citizen, who even, you know, herself is comfortable with not raising questions around the behavior, the ethics, the decorum of this bus full of white students who have yet to be questioned, you know, really questioned by this university or the police force about their behavior. She should be embarrassed. This whole community should be embarrassed. How many of those students were underage, for instance, right? And, you know, even those questions, right? Asha, Ariel, and Alexis weren't inebriated. But there's, again, these students, Mary Glisson, let's see here. I should drop some names so people know. Marissa Camacho, you know, there's a bus full of white females and males, you know, students at this campus, UAlbany, who were acting in poor taste, you know, and couldn't even, you know, the next day really describe the incident because they were inebriated. They couldn't remember. At least they gave that excuse, that justification.
Context of white supremacy. That is such a huge point. We've been ending every program for more than a year, saying, you know, sobriety would be best under conditions of racism, mm-hmm. and really encouraging that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, just mm-hmm. to hugely underline that you have suspected racists in this case that apparently were so intoxicated, or at least that's what they testified to, that they couldn't remember the details of an incident where they were allegedly assaulted. That's what's going to trial. That
right.
They were allegedly
right.
victims of an assault. Meanwhile, right. the black people that are accused of being perpetrators, these young black female scholars, they're sober. That's right. the system of racism, white supremacy right there, where you can have video of white people being unruly and drunk and maybe even underage. And that's, we don't even know their names. I am so appreciative. We don't even know their names because that happens so
right.
often.
Camacho. Right.
That happens so often just where whites who practice racism, they're not publicly identified. I even remember
we have to do that.
Renisha McBride, if folks remember, this is the black female in 2013 in Michigan where Ted Wafer shot her. He said he was afraid. Same thing. I'm a victim. Mm. And he literally shot her in the head, killed her on his mm-hmm. front lawn, and then called the police. They didn't release his name for the longest
right.
time.
Protected.
And
protected
it was
classes.
Why? You have literally
the
killed
truly protected classes.
Mm-hmm. Again, the system of racism. So, yeah, I super appreciate that. And I don't recall in any of this time having ever heard any of their names,
right.
anyone released any thought of a charge against any of these white mm-hmm. people on the bus. Or at minimum, let's have a campaign about all of this drinking that goes on these
exactly.
college campuses. We're going to get serious. We're tired of all of this debauchery on public buses.
Mm-hmm.
No more under eight. Like, even that, did you see any of that sort of thing happen?
No, not at all. And so even when Ariel, Alexis, and Aisha were called before a so-called student conduct committee on campus, again, I'm sitting here and I'm going, wow, you know, I'm a mother, my baby's just three. But if I were to fast forward years down the road and her being a college student there, and she's called before this so-called committee of judges on campus about her conduct as a student, And you know, really what that boils down to is her home training, right? As we talk about in the black community, you know, how you are raised, your home training. I would immediately be on guard against this university and this institution as being racist and it being a part of the system here, that this is even allowable, that they're questioning my daughter and her friends, but not these other students who were drunk, who the police know were drunk, who, again, did not call police for assistance, you know, who only, you know, later filed any sort of statement or signed a statement complaining after the university had, you know, urged them or encouraged them to do so and let them know that they were not being seen as, you know, criminals here, but victims, you know, not immediately, though. I would be questioning this institution as to how it is even plausible that you're questioning my baby, my child, and not a single one of these white students who the police, you know, documented, who, I mean, they couldn't help but document it was so clear that they were inebriated. So, no, never a question, not even from this institution, about student conduct. And so this is where we begin to see that the system is at work here, not about Asha, Aria, or Alexis in terms of their complaints. It goes beyond that when all eyes are directly and all fingers are pointed at the black body and not the white one.
Context of white supremacy, University of Albany professor, Dr. Ani. Folks have questions that they would like to ask. The number to dial 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you have a question. We will get you on the line to ask Dr. Ani. About the students, they were disciplined as well. They have, you have the legal criminal aspect of this, and then also the University of Albany, they placed their own disciplinary sanctions on the students in this case, which I know people have raised different concerns for a variety of reasons. I know at least myself and others, one of the things I think is super important is that the disciplinary proceedings happened before the criminal case has been resolved.
Right.
So you could have a situation where there is no criminal misconduct, where that ends
right.
up, they end up being found not guilty, but they have already been disciplined
right.
by the school. Like, but yes,
right.
can you talk about that?
Absolutely. You're right. Unless you're operating and functioning in a system that, you know, where the scale is tipped towards your side. And so there again, the point that you're raising, not only do we see these students being dragged literally through the mud, being taken off course, off focus in terms of their studies and their goals, to stand before a committee here on campus, at the university, but also by the same institution, by the university. The university is partial complainant here in this case, really. You know, you're quite clear in abreast to the criminal case because you're a part of that too. And so it literally just became, it was clearly a public lynching. They were an example. They were to serve as an example to the rest of the non-white student body here to stay in their place. If you dare attempt to shed light on any issues on this campus, whether it's racism, alcohol abuse, whether it's, you know, sex crimes, whether it's bias in, you know, policing on campus with the university police department, any of the above, you better be ready for all-out war because this entire institution is going to come at you. And that's what happened with these students. And the white students were, you know, who knows where they are? Who knows what, you know, just stop free, as we say, without any even, you know, out or more so of conduct, you know, or questioning by this institution. So the lesson for them was, you know, do what you want to do. And that's the very meaning, again, racism, white supremacy. This is your oasis. This is your institution. This is your community. Right back to the judge's statement.
Wow. Context of white supremacy. With at least the two students that have their cases pending for April, or really everybody, the mental health aspect of this,
yes.
You also, part of your research is understanding the impacts of racism, white supremacy on Pan-African identity. Can you, I mean, this is dragged on for over a year now, year and a half. It's going to be at minimum. Who knows
mm-hmm.
what could happen with the court case. Just can you talk about how this sort of thing has impacted the mental health of these three very young black female scholars?
Absolutely. You know, I tried very hard to be on the front end of that. Really, again, I try to stay on the vanguard here. And I was, you know, as much as I could, encouraging of all three of the young women, Asha, Alexis, Ariel, to stay the course in terms of their goals, in terms of their basically staying on campus, you know, stand your ground, hold your heads high, you have support here, and you have people who are waiting with you, as we're supposed to do in this system of so-called democracy, until the court, the case, you know, the whole investigation that course has, you know, taken place and due process has been had and you are found guilty or not guilty. Until that happens, you are, as we say, innocent until proven guilty or otherwise, and you have support, so stay here. Don't disenroll. Don't flee the scene, if you will. You know, don't leave, basically. And that was critical to me from the very beginning because I was very aware of how this could affect them mentally and spiritually. Here you are, as you said, young, goal-oriented college students who really, you know, this might have been, if we were talking about the migrations model, right, Cross's a theory of racial identity, black racial identity to be exact, this is really your encounter, your first direct encounter with racism. It's real. It's not something out there. It can happen to you. It can happen to any of us, and it happens daily. They had faced this head on. This was their encounter situation, right? And that's traumatizing. That is shocking. And it can certainly derail you in terms of your focus and your goal pursuit, your emotional stability. And that's exactly what happened. As you saw very quickly, Alexis was sort of swept away. You know, her family felt and she felt the pressure was too great. And she didn't feel, understandably, safe in terms of not just physically, but personally, her reputation, how my professors are going to grade me, judge me, and, you know, fairly. The other students, am I going to be accepted? Am I going to be shunned, right? And essentially exiled, you know, from, you know, regular campus activity. That weighs on any, it can weigh on anyone. And I felt the pressure and the strain for them, you know, through them. So, you know, some of the mental health issues we saw happen quickly with Alexis. And then shortly thereafter, well, with the student conduct hearing, all three of them were expelled anyway. So the university basically, excuse me, said, you're not welcome here, officially. You know, they expelled them. And when that happened, of course, there was an even bigger sort of surge of, well, now what? Because now they have to either they fold and say, there goes my college dreams, there goes my, you know, access or my sort of vehicle to upward mobility. We know how education and economics, that they correlate in this country. It is what it is. So they either fold under that, you know, judgment, or what? They apply elsewhere. Now, applying elsewhere, you now have this huge blemish on your official transcript, so that now when you apply to another institution, another college, they're going to question you about this exposure. What happened? Oh, okay, Google your name, and you're all over, you know, the internet and news portals as a liar, as someone who made false allegations, even before the trial has been completed. So literally, I mean, this is just, again, the entire system against these three young women for daring to lift, you know, raise their voices about their experience.
Wow. Man, that is the weight of it, just hearing, you know, as you're sharing, yeah, just what they have gone through. Like, I can feel it. Just, I hope they have lots of support, and people that have, mm-hmm, been with them are going to continue to be with them as they deal with this. But I mean, that's, mm-hmm, and I mean, for so many Black people, this is exactly how mental health is eroded. You have an incident like this, a job situation, or I mean, being, mm-hmm, in college, that's pretty much your career situation. Same thing, but you have an incident like that, and it ends up being extremely traumatizing. And I mean, you feel the total weight of the system of white supremacy and European pathology. It can really, and I mean, do long-term damage to your mental health, mental and spiritual well-being. We had Roz that dialed in with a question. Roz, did you have a question for Dr. Ani? You should be with us, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus, and greetings to you, Dr. Ani. It's really great to have you on the program this evening. I had a couple of questions for you, and I appreciate you being on the show. I think you actually just answered one of my questions, which was I was going to ask about the mental health of the Black females involved in this, just for the same reasons that you and Gus both elucidated. That pressure can really push us over the edge, so I'm really glad that you were able to give that update, but I did have a couple of other questions as well, and I will keep them in my prayers as well. One question I had was, have any white people come out in support of them in regards to actually lending credence to their story at all?
Mm-hmm. Lending credence? Wow.
As far as just like white people coming out saying that they believe what they were saying, and they're supporting them in regards to them trying to rectify the situation as far as the criminal case against them is concerned?
Yes. The short answer to that is, there is no short answer when we're dealing with such pathology, right? I would have to say, yes. The answer, and I hesitate because vocalizing your support and showing your support in terms of, by means of showing up at court cases and, you know, writing memos, writing letters, publishing features, this sort of thing, those things that can really sort of go a long way against, in terms of defense against the system, those things have not happened as much at all. What I've seen happen is because that pressure is so great, the stress is so real, and we're all at this point, you know, the vast majority of us are working to make it, to survive, their stamina just doesn't seem to be as great. And, you know, my theory, the only thing I can surmise is that it's because it's not, you know, directly their battle. In other words, they can cash in on their whiteness and really sort of, you know, retreat where we can't. It's not truly their battle. So no, and if that were the case, you would probably be able to mention some names. You know, you might have them on the show. But the reality is, no, we continue to be in a place, a space and time where we have to be the ones to really come together and fight this system. You know, we have to unify. Not really. No, certainly no students on the bus have come forward. There were statements made to police at that time that corroborated that, hey, no, people were fighting on both sides. I did see, I believe one of the white male students, in fact, was explicit about having four teeth on the black female student. And so what happened was, because the police were focused on quelling, you know, any racial overtones in the case, they didn't question further. They were, you know, just sort of left to hang in the balance, and their line of questioning shifted to where that wasn't investigated. So where perhaps those students, for instance, could come forward and say, you know what, no, I was there. I told the police what I saw. I expressed X, Y, and Z. That hasn't happened. And so what we've had to do was really go through these transcripts and uncover as much as we could to reveal the bias.
Wow. Thank you so much for your answer. It sounds like Dr. Marimba Ani's discussion on rhetorical ethics in regards to them cashing in on their whiteness, like you said. I wanted to ask for yourself and other black and non-white faculty and students who have supported them, has there been any sort of backlash against you and them as well in regards to them supporting these black females in this litigation?
Yes. I kind of addressed that a little bit with Mr. Renegade here earlier. You know, I'm catching hell every day up here, but it's the nature of the beast and the battle we have to fight. And so I soldier on. I attempted, for instance, that spring semester. I'm sorry, I didn't attempt. We were successful in holding a State of Black SUNY Albany for the first time, coordinated the town hall, a Black SUNY Albany town hall. And, you know, it was essentially hell to pay just to have a space where Black students, all Black students, faculty, staff could come together in one location and discuss their experiences, their interests, their concerns, and which way we're going to move forward, how we're going to move forward here at UAlbany. I was literally called at my home on the weekend by the chair of this department, Africana Studies, on behalf of the dean's office, to call the meeting off because it was racist. I was told that my holding an all-Black event, or an event where I focused on and called out all Black people on campus and community members to come together, was a violation of Title IV. And to cancel it, I said, it's not going to happen. I'm not canceling anything. We will meet on Monday. I believe the date was March 7th, I think. But things like that, and literally they had suits come out, you know. The police chief, UPD police chief Wiley, was present. Several other suits, people I don't know who didn't introduce themselves or speak at all. You know, some white, some black were present and attempted to make, you know, the environment very uncomfortable. But we again, we had the dialogue we used to have. I issued a report to this institution and made sure that was circulated to students, to faculty, everyone we could, to alert them to the incidences of bias by UPD here on campus against black students and the issues that the specifics around this case with the Asha, Alexis, and Ariel. And, you know, we set goals and made, you know, quite a bit of progress towards meeting them since then. But that incident, there are so many others in terms of my speaking somewhere on campus that, you know, there's such, there's conflict that's created just from us attempting to organize and come together. So that's happening on the regular here. And I know that it's about me sort of being branded as this activist professor.
Okay. And just, I wish you the best and please stay safe. And I'd like to thank you for being such a staunch warrior for justice. And my last question was, were you familiar with Dr. Marimba Ani's work? And did her work as a counter-racist warrior help inform your choice of last name? Thank you so much. I wish you the best. And I meet my line. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for your call, brother. I appreciate it. The question. You know what? Long story short, no. Yes, I am familiar with Dr. Ani Marimba Ani's work, of course. Absolutely. I am very much aware of her work. Yorugu, Let the Circle Be Unbroken. I actually read selections from that text, her earlier text, in my African family, African-American family class. And so, yes, absolutely. I must pay respect where it's due and speak highly of her, of that sister, and her warriorship. But my name, Amani Shaketi Ani, actually, I was named, literally, I asked to be bestowed an African name by an elder that I respected, and because I believe that's culturally sound, you know, rather than me choosing it myself, someone that I felt close to and felt knew me and would be an accurate judge of my character in alignment with our people, our history, our ancestors, our struggle. And who I am. And that person is Malefe Kede Asante out of Temple University. So Dr. Asante actually bestowed my name upon me, Amani Shaketi Ani, while in Kemet. And that's the beautiful part of that story. We were actually cruising on the Nile River in Kemet, and he held the naming ceremony for me there with the people who were traveling with us in Kemet. That is Egypt, modern day Egypt. Kemet. So, no, my name speaks to Ani. It's about community. It's about being all about and supportive of and always remembering, honoring our community. That's what Ani represents. And Amani Shaketo, often is how it's spelled. Amani Shaketo was a Nubian, a Kandake queen out of Nubia in Kemet around the 1st to 20th century BC.
Thank you so much for answering my questions. And I'll mute my line, but you're awesome. Incredible. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I wish you all the best. Stay safe, please.
Thank you. I will. Thank you, brother.
Good hearing from you, Roz. If other folks have questions, star 6, and we'll get you on the line with Dr. Ani. Are there any tangible things, like, is there, you know, is a case pending the next 30 to 45 days, any tangible things that we can do that would help either with promoting the case or supporting? As I said, we still have cases pending for Ms. Gudio and Ms. Burwell. Anything we can do?
Absolutely. The first thing I would mention is, again, I'm going to get that court date. I'll make sure that you have it. I'm sure you have other means as well, is staying abreast of the actual court date. But I'll make sure you have that. Show up, man. That's the biggest thing. Be present, you know, because our energy, our spirit, is valued, you know, when we're present. Just that alone. Have them having to be accosted by our presence and our diligence and our unity you know, that changes things. It literally does. That's just the laws of physics. So be there. If you can make it, come to the court hearing, the next court gate. I'll give that to you again, April. That's one. But two, honestly, this, you know, this is wonderful. Having invited me again, I'm grateful and honored to have shared any amount of new information and just encouragement, spirit that I could offer regarding the case and on your radio program. Continue to beat the drum, to speak about the case, keep people consciously, you know, aware of it occurring right here in our midst, and that there are things they can do, like showing up to court. Don't let folks forget. Continue to beat the drum verbally on your radio station, but then also push the letters that have been written. I've written a letter to the president, interim president Steller, and to the entire board of trustees. I've written a letter. I never even heard back from the board of trustees because it is their job to hire and essentially hold accountable the leadership on campus. So I wrote to them, are you aware of this case of egregious of the facts here? That not one of the 35 or so white students were, you know, questioned before a student conduct hearing. That criminal charges were filed and these girls were expelled before an investigation was completed, you know, et cetera. Are you aware? And is this, does this wash with the university's or the entire SUNY system's mission and expectations for its leadership, you know? And so push those things and make sure people are talking about the case. And as the brother said, keeping these young women in high spirit and prayer, I think those are the things that we are commissioned to do in a case like this, a situation like this. I'll make sure you get anything you want. You just let me know and I'll give it to you.
Oh, for sure. Ashe, I appreciate it. Have you been, like folks have been reaching out to you to do interviews? I think that was one of the issues that was raised by the filmmakers of Indefensible, which I hope folks have checked out about this case. But they were saying that, you know, they were going and just grabbing random white students at UAlbany to talk to them and get their views. But people like you, they felt like were not getting the same amount of attention and airtime.
You know what? I gave a lot of statements. I have to recognize the Times Union for being at least the most audacious, you know, brave is as far as U.S., you know, media goes. In other words, they could be braver and more audacious, but they have printed several of my statements and Deidre Dunson, I believe is her last name, other folks who have, you know, been those to raise questions and say, wait, something's off here. Something's not right. This is one-sided. You know, we've raised critical questions that the university doesn't seem to be raising, et cetera. The Times Union has been the only one. I have given, it's funny because I'm chuckling, I remember standing outside of the court building, I think the last two court cases, and giving statements to the press that never saw the light of day, which just means they didn't like what I had to say. You know, very articulate, very, you know, fact-based. There was no reason for them not to include my statements or my interviews, but they didn't, right? Their editors or what have you said, you know, that's not sensational. You know, that's not the story right now is they lied, and that's what we're pushing. So that is sort of as it must be and or as it is, and why we have to ourselves continue to beat the drum and do what it is we have to do to make sure, you know, that justice at least has an opportunity, at least an opportunity to be rendered here for these sisters.
Right on. The caller at 8617, did you have a question for Dr. Ani?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, good evening to you, Gus, and greetings to the Dr. Ani as well. I only had one question. Were you familiar with the students prior, the young scholars, prior to this incident taking place? and I'll take my call offline. Thank you.
I think I caught the essence of his question.
Caller, did you want to repeat? Did you want to repeat your question just to make sure we both heard it?
Oh, sure. I was just asking if you were familiar with the young scholars before this incident had taken place.
Okay, I can answer that. Mm-hmm. I was not directly, so here's the thing. I was not directly familiar with neither any of the three women, Asha, Ariel, or Alexis, before this incident took place. However, and it's a part of, I think, being on a PWI, a predominantly white institution, or the PWI campus, and being a professor like myself, who is an Africana Studies professor, also vocal, and presence is known on campus as far as attending events and speaking, being the keynote speaker, this sort of thing. So I know at least one of the students, Asha, was aware of me and knew of me and felt comfortable, therefore, with pretty immediately speaking with me candidly and, you know, being vulnerable about how she was really doing and feeling and her concerns and details about that night and the incident that she perhaps didn't share and others didn't share with other people. The press included, and largely at the instruction of their counsel, their legal team. So I wasn't familiar directly with them, directly familiar. However, you know, that's the essence, I think, of family and understanding that that's your biological family, but then also your community and those with whom you share political destiny. You know, they were very, it was very quick after the incident that we establish a relationship.
All right. Thank you for answering my question, and fantastic work to you both. And definitely keep up the good work. Stay safe. Thank you.
Thank you. You did the same.
Appreciate that. Caller 1184, did you have a question? No.
Yes. Greetings.
Greetings.
Not able to hear you. Your volume got very low.
We used to cuss Dr. Ani.
Greetings.
Yes, I just wanted to say that I'm trying to listen to the program, and I'm having trouble with her signal. It seems to be like underwater sounding, but all the rest of the voices seem normal.
Are you saying you can't hear me?
I don't know if any other people noticed that yet.
It sounded a little faint at first, but I'm able to hear her now. I can hear her as clearly as I'm hearing you or any of the other callers. I think Roz, it seemed like he was able to hear okay. I guess Roz, I can ask him again. Roz, if you're able to check in, are you able to hear Dr. Ani okay?
Yes, I've been able to hear her clear for most of the program. I haven't heard her sound like she's underwater. So I've heard her clearly, and you as well. And even the black male who just actually said that, I heard him clear too, so I'm not getting any reception issues on my end.
Hmm. Okay.
All right, if I could just ask Dr. Ani briefly, what is your line of work?
Okay, I'm an assistant professor at the University at Albany, the Department of Africana Studies.
Right on. Appreciate that, 1184, and thank you for the volume check. Hopefully, I'll double check the archives, but yeah, I can hear Dr. Ani okay, and I'll check in with some of the other listeners as well if you have an issue or what have you, or just let us know if the sound is okay. Also wanted to ask with the case specifically, I guess, I know when we talked to some of the filmmakers, they said that with one of the young ladies that she did go ahead and just take the plea deal, which involved just saying that you agree, like publicly saying, yes, I did make this up. And she got like community service and probation. She did take the plea deal. We had some of the filmmakers on the program. They said that they in terms of what they would wish, they wish that all three of them had taken the plea deal just so that there's no risk of any jail time or anything more draconian happening with the proceedings continuing. That, you know, certainly you want to fight for justice, and everybody kind of has that ideal, you know, yeah, I'll stand up and I'll show them. But just the reality, you know, when you're a young person, and as you were saying before, kind of having this on your record forever, every time you try to get a job or just try to resume with your education, just your thoughts on people will say, well, hey, one of them, they took the plea deal. I think all of them should have taken the plea deal and just be done with all of this.
Well, and that's the thing that you just ended on, just be done with all of this. And people may think that, but the reality is you're not done with it. It sticks with you. It stays with you. You know, no, in terms of my own position, and of course, I mentioned my own daughter minutes ago. It's something that, as you said, we could all, you know, we can understand at least the thought process. You know, take the PDQ, be done, but you have to think about what that actually means substantively. In other words, just listen to that, what it's called, right? And let's deal with this etymology, the root words here. Plea, a plea deal, right? A deal is something you sort of negotiate, right? You have some say in. You have, you know, you might say equal power in terms of what you get, how you're benefited, and the other party is also negotiating on their own behalf to benefit in some way. It's a deal. Right? However, you put plea in front of that, a plea deal, and what a plea is, that's a cry. That's a beg for something, right? You're begging, literally begging this system for mercy on you. Take it easy on me, right? A plea deal. I will offer you something. In this case, it is admission of guilt that you might then give me a lesser, you know, jail sentence or time. It's extremely, you know, it speaks to, again, this system, and how justice is actually supposed to work. And, you know, if there's wrongdoing, reciprocity, you know, righteousness would have it that, well, then you get, you know, you sort of, you do the time, you pay the crime, right? We're going to do a thorough investigation. You're going to be judged accordingly, et cetera, and a verdict is going to be rendered. But in this system, where so-called plea deals are offered at the outset of a case, before investigation, before questioning, before testimonies and all of these things, again, you have to really pay attention to and be aware, be conscious of this system, who you are to this system, within this system, and what, you know, that plea deal might mean for you now and later on down the road. Let me also say, in that instance with the plea deal, I was sitting in court the day that the DA's office, you know, offered this so-called plea deal. And what's striking is that there was no deal at all. They literally wanted these three young women to accept the plea deal, for which they had no idea what the course of action would be. Typically, you know, you give us this, we'll give you that. Admit some wrongdoing, we believe you're guilty. If you admit that, then we will, you know, give you community service, no jail time, or a fine, you know, and a shorten the minimum sentence of jail time, etc. They didn't give any of that. It was just admit, apologize, submit, and, you know, we'll give you something at our to our discretion. It all, again, system against these three young women. And I remember sitting in court and the entire court sort of murmuring and laughing as their counsel was saying, the defense was saying, but what are you offering? What's the deal? You know, we can't advise our clients to accept a plea deal for which they have no idea what the parameters are. So that's important to understand as well. Alexis, we wish her well. I was saddened when she took the plea deal. But again, as you said, also understood that her family, herself perhaps, you know, was under that pressure and felt like that would be the best thing for her to do at that time, and just to sort of, you know, move on some level without having to come back up for court or, you know, continue to be in the papers, online and news, et cetera. But this whole issue around that plea deal was really all about submission, it was all about, you know, being, I guess, carrying the burden of this entire incident and all of the bad publicity, everything. They wanted to just to literally, you know, throw it on their backs. And essentially shame them before the world. That's what the plea deal was all about.
Wow. Wow. And this is Alexis Briggs, the victim of racism in this case, the young lady where she did take the plea deal. And I would kind of remind folks, they were talking about the new docuseries that's supposed to address Kalief Browder. He chose not to take the plea deal and ended up being incarcerated for 3 years. Things can go, racists can make things very hard on you if you choose to not accept their plea deal. And that's so, and they intend for that sort of thing to kind of be hanging over you. Like, hey, if you don't want to take that, no problem, but we're going to make things tough on you if you don't take that deal. They tend to pressure us when they, as you said, discretion. I've said that before. I have a whole tab just on how discretion operates in the system of racism, white supremacy, where they can just arbitrarily decide what they're going to do, how they're going to adjudicate a particular situation. And that always is going to mean very bad things, very bad outcomes for black people. I wanted to make sure I asked as well. I had one question that's kind of not related to the case. It kind of deals with your scholarship before we let you enjoy the rest of your evening and be a mom. But just with the case, I thought the campaign, number one, if we missed anything that's important, I thought it was also extremely important. We talked about it with some of the filmmakers in terms of even black people being fooled and just the impact. I thought it was so great in the film Indefensible, where they showed these young ladies having, on like CNN, mainstream news reports, having the words false, like branded across their body. And they would like have this up for the whole 5 minute segment where you would have that image. So that's influencing the way that you think about this case, where they talked about they would crop some of the images where they would be in court for like the arraignment to make it look like they were handcuffed and shackled. And that just has such a huge impact on the way that we think about these young ladies. Were there any other details like that where you thought, hey, they've done a great job in making it so that black people, even black people, think, yeah, I don't want to support them. They lied, they made this up, and I'm not going to go support them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think the sort of penultimate example is the very video footage, the clip that the DA's office released. I said on another interview, I was interviewed with a brother in the community, Sean Moore, with Danny B in the morning here in the city. And I'm blanking, 96.3 is the radio dial. And at that time, I'd, you know, made it known that I was one of a small, big club, right, of handpicked people from this institution, UAlbany, and other parts of the community, various activists, you know, those, you know, identified as leaders in the community, to sit in the DA's office in February before charges were filed and to review the extended video of the CDTA video footage, as well as hear some of the 911 calls and to read some of the student statements. And what has troubled me, having sat in that meeting in the DA's office and then go home and just within a few weeks time see only a good 1 or 2 minute clip being, you know, repeatedly shown by the media. And that 1 or 2 minutes was of the very end, the last few moments of this physical altercation, where it was Ariel Agudio attempting to pick up her hair. She had tracks in her hair, and her hair was pulled out during this altercation by apparently Marissa Camacho, who confessed to it, which, again, something happened. There was an altercation. It wasn't one-sided, et cetera. But what troubles me is that there is no context whatsoever offered, neither offered or really discussed in the media, offered by the DA's office or the university and UTD or the media in terms of what led to the altercation and the fact that there was a real sense of there being offense, assault, violation of these girls' space and of their person, their body, that still needs to be investigated. So whereas we sat in the DA's office and watched the events leading up to the altercation, where you see literally commotion, conversation being initiated on the side of the bus where these white teens are sitting, directed towards Asha, Alexis, and Ariel, and not the other way around. We're then having to sit and deliberate around what's being said and how it aligns with the three girls' statements versus these white students. And it's very clear that it was initiated and instigated by these white students. You know, around these drunk white girls singing 99 bottles of beer on the wall, being obnoxious, and then the rest of the bus, much of the bus, joining in. So we are now, Asha, Ariel, and Alexis feel completely isolated and on their own on these students' turf. And so, you know, things escalate and the actual physical altercation, the fight happens. But on the media, all you see are these three young black women defending themselves and fighting back, which then becomes spun as they're being the aggressor.
Wow. Did you participate in the documentary at all, Indefensible, which is about this case?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I offered information.
Okay.
I was unavailable for interview to be, you know, in the documentary, but I offered a lot of information and largely, essentially, the facts they were able to speak from. And it was great that they had the actual interrogation video included. They did an awesome job. The Black Lives Matter crew and their associates, they did a great job on that documentary.
I concur. You can download it. You can watch it on YouTube. I've posted the links for it. And when we had some of the filmmakers with us on the program, they made the links available, right, so that people can check out the police footage that was made available. You can see it all. They, like you said, they put it on this obscure site, and it's all huge. But you can download it. You can check it out. And that also was huge. It reminded me so much of Ida B. Wells Barnett when she talked about racists had tricked her, too. She said she used to, when the lynchings and what have you, she believed it. When they said, oh, yeah, they were raping white women or whatever they said, she said she believed it. And then it happened to some of her friends. She was like, wait a minute, y'all are lying. Like, right. I was, right. That right. They are very, very good at that, being able to victimize us and where they can trick a lot of us. But exactly what you talked about, that documentary and just kind of understanding some of the things that happened in this case, where you can see this is just racism that's operating,
that's
and
right.
These black ladies were victimized.
It's certainly frustrating. And to your point, if we understand how racism, white supremacy is propagated, how it works, then you understand immediately to question everything you see on TV and newspapers, because it's all propagandists. All propagandists support this system. And so that's a part of, again, racism is not this thing, you know, that exists in some vacuum, or that we can't, again, see and readily decipher and deconstruct and analyze and talk about and actually confront. It's the way in which our experiences are talked about. It's the way in which they're reported. It's culture. You know, as you said that repeatedly. It's not a single act of racism or, you know, one person over here. It's the system, and either you're silent about how the system is operating and how things are reported, et cetera, or you are on the front lines against it. And if you're not on the front lines against it, if you're not talking about it, confronting it, then you are supporting it. Period. And so it frustrates me that not enough of our people raise questions. No matter what you show me, I have questions. I walked into that office with questions. And after I saw the videos, et cetera, I had questions, because I don't trust that you see the same things I see, because we come from different places in which we are held to a different status and treated differently in this system. So we're not going to look at and address the same, you know, the same things in the same way. We're not. We're going to come at it. We're going to see it. We're going to interrogate it differently. So, absolutely, we have to. We have to constantly be on the guard and raise the question because we're not there yet.
Asking questions, hugely important. Our guest, Dr. Amani Shaket Ani. I wanted to ask, there was an incident that happened over the weekend. Desmond Cole, he's a black journalist in Canada, and he had been talking about an incident where a young black girl, like 6-year-olds, when I say young, 6-year-old black girl, where she had been mistreated. And her mom was trying to address the issue, and her mom, a different white faculty member, called her mom a nigger. I think she said something specifically like, "Is that nigger talking to the press again?" Like, she was same type of thing, upset that, you know, you're getting bad press and, you know, accusing us of being racist.
Right.
And
yeah.
So this went on for months. I think it was witnesses that she said this, and she denied it at first, and then she made up all these wacky excuses about having an injury and. Anyway, so this went on for months. She finally resigned. And a different white person, this was a school official, so a different white person who was in charge of things that happened with related to education there, he said that just as you just stated, she didn't do anything. She didn't stand up and say, "Hey, we are not going to tolerate having officials calling black people niggers, period. That is unacceptable, and you are going to be packing your bags today." Like, that did not happen. They just sat around and made excuses and had no comment, and I don't think she's a racist and did all this. And so they had, Desmond Cole, he had a meeting with this one particular white woman, and he said, "You know, your conduct, you haven't done anything. You didn't stand up to call out this white woman for calling her a nigger. I'm not going to shake your hand." And the white woman got, like, really offended. She got really angry and like, "Oh, that's rude and unprofessional and we can't even be cordial." And he says, "Well, you are supporting someone practicing racism." She called a parent a nigger. And you didn't stand up. You never said this was incorrect. You didn't push to say that she needs to step down. You didn't do any of that. Why do I need to act like there's some, you know, level of respect or regard? You clearly demonstrated that you don't value black life. I'm not going to shake your hand." And I thought, wow, that is amazing self-respect. Wow. What do you think about that act?
I think that's awesome. I think that is a black man, an African man, standing in his Africanism, his blackness. And that's what we must do, you know, because until we do that, then, you know, we're fair game. We're fair game for any treatment, any level of bias, you know, whether it's within the legal system or our schools or our places of work, et cetera, in the grocery store, you know, anywhere in the system, unless and until we begin to actually call it, as we say, a spade a spade. And say, "No, I'm not going to shut them down and pretend with you. I saw what you did. I know you. I saw what you didn't do." Again, sometimes it's about what we don't do. I think the definition of character. You know, character is not, it's not always about being nice. Character is about honesty. It's about integrity, and it's about your demanding and commanding respect. And, you know, that only comes where it's due. We still don't get that as a people, that you have to demand that. You command it. You teach people how to treat you. And, again, you're very clear about who your allies are and really how serious individual and systemic, both, you know, alike, acts of racism actually are. You know, so had he shook her hand to me, that would be an indication from that man, that black man, that wasn't so bad. That's acceptable. I can accept you and I can befriend you. I can treat you with the same level of respect and embrace you to the same degree as I would a friend of mine, you know, someone who, as he says, respects black life and knows, you know, better not to call me by a slur that my ancestors were called, that, you know, we're only called when it's accompanied by a certain indignity and dignified treatment. So I think that's, as you said, brilliant. And that's exactly what we have to all begin to do, to have the courage and the character to be safe everywhere.
Ashe. I am so super impressed. We will if you have the time, being a mom and professor and everything, but if you have the time down the road to check back in on the case, it would be grand to speak with you again. We'll definitely be waiting for April when this comes up to follow the case and make sure everybody's informed. I know we have listeners in the New York area, so folks can go support or just posting, making sure that people do not forget, remember this case and are paying attention to it when things happen in April. We will definitely keep our listening audience updated. And we're adding to, we always love adding to the reading list. So we got Race and Manifest Destiny, already got that there. And then we'll be waiting for To the Mothers of White Men down the road for later in the year. We'll have two from Dr. Amani Shaket Ani. Great information. Really, really thankful that you could share some of your Monday evening with us.
Absolutely. I'm humbled and honored, as I said before, to have been invited and to have in any way benefited the call and heard of the case. So it would be my pleasure to come back anytime.
Right on. Thank you again. I'll post the links so that people, if you have not seen the documentary, you can check that out. And then other information, I'll just post it on Facebook and Twitter so that people can be abreast of what's happening with the case. Thank you so much. I know you've had a long day. Get rest. Take tremendous care of your Black mental health as well. And we will speak with you soon, Dr. Ani.
Thank you. Freedom ain't free. I'll work for it. Appreciate you.
For sure. Take great care.
Have a wonderful night.
You too. You too. Thank you. Context of White Supremacy. Dr. Amani Shaket Ani joining us. She's a professor at the University of Albany up in New York. Not New York City, upstate New York, but in New York. Great having her on the program. I forgot she is gorgeous. I forgot to say, I don't know if that's professional, but she is absolutely gorgeous to see a Black female scholar with pretty accurate insight about racism, white supremacy, familiar with Mr. Fuller and Dr. Welsing's work and Dr. Ani, Dr. Marimba Ani Yerugu, familiar with her work and everything. And she is stunningly gorgeous. Like, wow. Wowie. Anyway, context of white supremacy, we'll give a moment if folks have any commentary that they want to share with this. People that have followed this case for a year, I'm sure we have some people who just, you know, heard of this. I'm sure we have newer listeners, right? So some people that may not have heard or been keeping up with this case. But definitely, I think some people said that before. If you can, once you have a better understanding of racism, white supremacy, you can see a lot of different things stand out if you watch cases evolve. Because sometimes after the initial uproar, and they talk about it a lot for the first few days or what have you, especially if it's a trial and all of that, it could take a year, it could take a year and a half, it could take years to see everything unfold. And when you get to watch the whole thing, and I mean really analyze, like I think one of our callers in Louisiana, Brittany, unless I'm mistaken, she mentioned Mr. Fuller when he did a broadcast not that long ago. He said, when you come out and you give your speech or whatever you do, you give your mic drop, that's act one. Now, what's going to be act two and act three and act four and act five? You're saying basically that victims of racism, a lot of times, all we have is act one. We do not have the whole play put together. You get to see these incidents that last a year, 2 years, 3 years. You get to see racist man, racist woman, racist child. They have the whole act and the encore performance put together flawlessly, where they have rehearsed, they have got their words together, they got their script together about how this is going to operate. Already got it together, and you just see it go from one step to the next, and you see all of the components to it. This is what the press will do our job. What we choose to cover, what we don't choose to cover, the images that we use, the language that we use in describing the case, the photos that we use. The university, we do our part. We're going to take disciplinary action even before the criminal case has been adjudicated. They might not be guilty of a crime, but we've already disciplined them as though they are. You just see all of the different facets that work towards the result. Always, everything is about racism, white supremacy, and particularly when you have Black people making an allegation of racism, white people tend to go to work. That's been my experience. Same thing, like I just mentioned with this case in Canada. You had a Black parent just advocating for her child, her very young child, I might add, but just advocating for her child, and bam, she's called a nigger. And same thing, it's not even on what needs to be done about white people practicing racism. It ends up being about everything else. And these parents are up here just, you know, being an annoyance and being gadflies and making all this unnecessary attention, and their children are unruly anyway. It becomes all this other focus on the victims as opposed to the white perpetrators. I'm going to use Dr. Ani's term again, pathological culture and thought in European behavior. That's what's on display all the time, but that ends up not being the focus. It always ends up coming back on us, victims of racism, and us sometimes literally being the ones that are being adjudicated. I know people were saying the same type of thing when the Trayvon Martin case happened. We'll take a quick break, and then if anybody has any thoughts or comments that they want to share or audio check, you can get that in before we wrap things up. I'm just replaying because this incident involved alcohol and white women in a public space. I'm replaying the audio where Mr. Fuller talked about the danger of this sort of situation. And this is not victim blaming. This is just a reminder for everyone. You can put Gus at the top of the list. This is a general reminder for all of us what racism, white supremacy means. We are in danger. Take that seriously. You're in any environment where it seems like there's some whites and they might be drunk and being unruly. Like, oh, man. This is danger. Like, that should be in the forefront of your mind. Like, do I need to get out of here? Like, I'm talking to Gus. I'm talking to anybody. Like, these incidents happen so frequently. And I mean, it can go in a matter of seconds from everything is relatively calm and you just, the drunk white people are being goofy, to total chaos. Police are being called. Blood has been spilled. There's a brawl. Just, I have seen that. We have reported on this over and over and over and over. One of the deadliest combinations in the known universe, whites and alcohol. Mr. Fuller, one time, and then if folks have any comments that they want to get in, we will wrap things up. This is Neely Fuller Jr. just talking about the danger of white people in general. This happened to be a white woman specifically.
White woman with hair. With hair. With hair. Niggas don't take precedence over that. Over that. Over that. Period. Period. Now, see, that got way out of hand. And see, of course, this is all Monday morning quarterbacking I'm doing here, but. See, a person has to be conscious. These are life-changing things. People have to be aware of that. Things come out of nowhere. You have to be on your toes all the time. And you got to always come up with the what-ifs in just a few minutes. And you can't look at it like you got anybody on your side. So everything has got to be almost, you know, hey, open and shut. Now, when the ladies start tossing her hair back there, that's got to be thought of immediately. Uh-oh, here we go. Here's a life-changing incident. Everybody involved in here now is going to be, they're going to be dogged with this incident the rest of their lives. That's the way to look at it.
So right now with the red shirt, look at me in my eye, directly in my eye, and say, you're next, you're next.
White woman tossing her hair on some black people and whatnot in a restaurant full of white people and all like that. You think you're going to get the best of that story? Not at all. That's the way you're supposed to be thinking. This is a war situation here, and we are surrounded by enemy. With reinforcements coming. With reinforcements coming. Now, if you're not prepared to kill everybody who's an aggressor, you don't show no signs of aggression. You surrender in that situation. Have to.
When you say surrender, what do you mean?
You don't make no protests. I wouldn't. That white woman tossing her hair over there, I would go and ask for another booth or something. If I couldn't settle it with her, if I asked her not to do that, she says she's not going to do it. Kiss her, whatever. I would just go and say, well, I need another booth because we're having a problem over here. Okay. And if they don't want to give me another booth and all like that, well then, hey, maybe this ain't the place I should be no way. That's just the way it is. Your antenna has got to be up. That, you know, this race thing doesn't go away. It dominates everything. That's got to be in your mind all the time. Now, that's a terrible way to have to be in the world, but that's what I talk about. That's the world that we're in. You know, and when everything is relatively quiet and whatnot, people call in the programs and all like that and say, you know, well, you know, hey, he's old school and whatnot, and he's making it all up. It ain't got nothing to do with what's happening now. My experience has been this, and my experience has been that, and that's when you drop your guard. And that's when you lose your job, and 5 years later, you are in the lockup on account of your financial situation has gone completely to pot for the rest of your life. That's how they do it. It ain't by magic. It's all by plan. And that white woman would say, yeah, I just toss my hair on them niggas, you know. Hey, white woman white with hair. Woman with hair, you know? Hair, you know? Niggas don't niggas take precedence over that. Period. Period. You got to learn the hard way. They did.
Context of white supremacy, that is Mr. Neely Fuller Jr., producejustice.com, producejustice.com. Always think that bears repeating, and again, it's not victim blaming. It's just a reminder for Gus, first and foremost, that the system of white supremacy, white people are at war against non-white people. I had this discussion yesterday. I had a non-white person. They said, I do not want to go through my life thinking that white people are consciously, every single white person, white man, white woman, white child, every single one of them is consciously at war against me. At a non-white person tell me that they did not. They refuse to go through life thinking that way. And the only thing I can say is either it's true or it's not. If that is true and we are not thinking, adjusting our behavior to that truth, we are going to have lots and lots of problems. It's just going to be a daily epidemic of problems if we are unable to accept and appropriately adjust our behavior to that truth. Very, very simple. But these sort of incidents, in my opinion, a part of it is, I think, just, I mean, it has got to be no wiggle room. What does it mean to be white? And recognizing that these folks are dangerous. Dangerous. Really making sure that my attention is up when I'm around them. I'm paying attention. And, these are white people that look like they are under the influence. I really got to be alert. I think Roz has talked about that, being on the subway, public transportation, right? We got people that commute. You're in those sort of environments. You really got to be mindful because this could end up being a problem. And I maybe already need to be thinking, do I need to get off if I'm on a bus? Do I need to get off a stop early? Do I need to move if I'm on the subway? Do I need to go to another car to just avoid this whole situation? Because just as Mr. Fuller said, and I've seen this, we've had listeners who have gone through this, these situations can escalate so fast, and it's not going to, like, 10 times out of 9, it's not going to work in your favor if you're a black person. Any sort of thing where it's a disturbance, enforcement officials have to be called. It gets what they call serious. Oh, man, that is not going to work out in your interest at all. I can't think of any, even situations where the black person didn't do anything. There was no self-defense. The black person just got totally mauled. I've still seen where it ended up, where it was just trouble and problems for them. They ended up being interrogated, and maybe you moved your head in front of the white person's fist, and this sort of nonsense, or I can't even say nonsense, that's white terrorism. That's what it is. So, I mean, just saying all that to really emphasize, that's why I say, you know, we probably don't want to be in too many environments where it's going to be a lot of alcohol and that sort of thing. And I know that's terrible because, you know, these are young folks that we're talking about this evening. Having been a young person, I know what it's like. You want to go out. You want to have fun. Your college years or your high school years or whatever. You even have a lot of adults who are trained to think that way. I understand all of that. I'm not even saying not to do it. I'm just saying that, you know, hey, even when we go have fun, we're still on the plantation. We got to have a code about how we have our fun, and that code might have to involve a lot of different things. If white people are present and we're having fun, that might, you know, minimize how much fun can be had. We got to be alert about what's going down. Just something that I think bears keeping in mind. And again, I'm talking to Gus T. Renegade first and foremost. There is a problem. That problem is white people, and I have concluded that yes, they are dedicated consciously at war with black people worldwide, all areas of people activity. And I have not located the white people that are not engaged in that activity. Anyway, folks that dialed in, Roz or other folks had any comments that they wanted to get in about the case, what they heard from Dr. Ani, feel free. I am so eager. I'm going to email her about her book to a letter to the mothers of white men, or it's to the mothers of white men. I'm going to email her about the book and see if we can get that as well. The other book that she recommended that we check out for the program. I downloaded it. It's Reginald Horseman, Race and Manifest Destiny. That was the book that she recommended. Might want to add that to your library. I downloaded mine. We might consider reading it for the book club. I'll check if anybody else. Roz, do you have anything you want to share before we wrap things up?
Yes, sir. Gus, greetings to you once again. This whole story is pretty saddening to me that these young ladies have to be put through this type of terrorism. But again, like you've been stating for as long as I've been listening to you, that is sadly the system of white supremacy. They're just getting completely railroaded. I thought of Khalif Browder, like, immediately, just with one of them taking the plea deal just to kind of end the tyranny as early as possible, even though that'll be a blemish on her her criminal record. And then the other two who are choosing to take Mr. Browder's route of fighting this because they are innocent. I understand their approach as well, VGQ, and I totally understand that. That they don't want to tarnish their criminal reputation and their personal reputation because of this incident. But I think it's a great example of white people forming like Voltron. It's something we can use as a case study to, like, forward that information to other, maybe more confused non-white people about how white people function. I thought that Dr. Ani was brilliant. It was so great to have a less confused professor on the program. She is beautiful, too, so I have to, you know, do my black self-respect in that level. She is beautiful, and I think just listening to her understanding of the system made her that much more beautiful to me. Just to hear a less confused person who really understands what's going on, I wish her a lot of safety because New York, and I know about Albany quite well. My mother used to travel up there for her job working for New York State, New York State Department of Taxation and Finance. And then also, we have a family friend from that same area. She's actually the original singer for the Black Eyed Peas. And she's from that area, and she now lives in Brooklyn. And I've heard stories about how white people function up in that area, so it can be very serious sometimes. And I have a cousin up there, too. So I'm wishing her a lot of safety. Excuse me. The clip that you played with Neely Fuller is one of my favorite clips because it focuses on the white female, again, F-E-E-M-A-L-E. They will make you pay. And sadly, they can make you pay with your life, like Carolyn Bryant did with Emmett Till. And I just think that's a very important clip just to show what you were saying, just how things can really take off very quickly. It doesn't take much. And yes, I have brought it up with white people and alcohol, riding the train quite regularly. There's people I've seen on a semi-regular basis, you know, 6 in the morning, they have their beer. After work in the evening, I'm traveling home, same person, they have their beer. So you never know what type of situation or state that these white people are in when you encounter them. They tend to do drugs all the time. They do drugs on their job. They run to the bathroom and do drugs where I work. There is an open alcohol policy, so there's hard liquor there. There's beer there. I don't partake of any of it. They've had to put up signs on the job when I first started working there about people watching their alcohol intake, and then they actually started to make rules that you can only start drinking an hour before you leave because white people like to get high more than anything else after abusing black people and terrorizing us. They love to get high. And it's something to really be abreast of because it is epidemic with them. I don't care if they're young white people. They like to drink, too. And like Gus said, when I was young, I drank hard liquor myself at a very young age, you know, ran the streets and did dumb things. Now that I'm older, I'm mortified, and I really say I'm really lucky that I never got caught up in anything fatal or ended up in jail or anything like that. So I definitely implore sobriety would be best. It would be best. Thank you so much, Gus, for the show. It was really great, and I would love to have her back. And I would love to read her text, too, just to see her mindset and how she formulates her thoughts and ideas on racism. I think it would be very insightful. Thanks again for having the show. I love what you do, and keep doing what you're doing, and I will be supporting. Thank you, and I'll meet my line.
Appreciate that, Roz. I'm excited. Like I said, I'm gonna get my mailing address together so that I can get a copy of the book. Let me see if I can hold her to that. She said she'd be down to mail me a copy of To the Mothers of White Men.
Gus, thanks for suggesting. I had a quick question for you.
Yes, sir.
But thank you so much. I apologize. I just wanted to know if you can email me your new address, because I don't know if it's the same in Amazon as it used to be or if it's changed from that. So I just wanted to know so that way I have the updated information there. So when I do, you know, get things for you, that I know I have it going to the right address or whatever the case may be. Okay.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah, appreciate that as well. For sure. For sure. We will definitely, I'll share information. If I can get, Dr. Ani's book, already encourage folks to check out, her reading list. The role of these white women in the case should not be understated. I don't know if that'll come up in the trial. I certainly will emphasize it, you know, when things come up next month. But yeah, and hopefully we can have Dr. Ani on the program again next month for the update as to, you know, what's transpiring with the case. And I agree, this is a good case study. There's a lot of material because so many people were talking about this, Hillary Clinton and all that. You can go back. There's a lot of archival footage over a long period of time. It'll be like 18 months, probably at least 18 months by the time at least the criminal phase of it ends. So to be able to see what the coverage looked like at the very beginning, where, you know, when it changed, how it's evolved, where it's at now, probably be something where you could do some great projects. And I would definitely say for any of the folks, if you listen to the program or you listen to any counter-racist programming and incidents like this come up, that, you know, really spark your attention for whatever reason. It just, you know, it piques your curiosity where you think this could have happened to you, or you've been, like, if you were, are you University of Albany alum, and so you're really interested in this, or just for whatever reason, any of the incidents that you see that you have an especially high interest in, you should look for ways that you can, you know, be more involved. If that means writing something, if that means doing a video project, if that means doing a documentary, you can do the Indefensible documentary is 30 minutes. You don't have to do, you know, a 2-hour, 3-hour document, 30 minutes. Or whatever it is. It could be an art project. It could be, you know, a series of paintings, whatever. Whatever the idea or the notion is, if you find a subject matter or a specific incident where you see that you're paying attention to it and you're daily, you know, looking for the updates, looking for the information, and just really interested to know what's happening, see if you can find a way to use that information. See if you can find a way to do something with that energy and with that interest. I think more of us should be looking for projects, ways that we can get involved with regards to racism, white supremacy. We already have a lot of folks who are spectating. That's not going to solve this problem. Also, make sure I get in the audio. I'll double check. I emailed Thomas because I think he said at the beginning her volume just sounded low to him. He wanted her to speak up a little bit. It was not crystal, but I didn't have any problems hearing. I think Roz said, you know, she was coming through okay. I think we had another caller who dialed in as well, so I guess he could hear okay enough to get his question through. But I'll double check the archives and see if any adjustments need to be made or see what it sounded like for the recording. But hopefully will come through clean. We'll see how it goes. Just, and again, any of the folks, if you are having audio problems or if the page is not loaded, you can feel free to email me, untiljustice@gmail.com. I generally try to keep my email up during the broadcast, so I'll see. If it's anything that I can do to try to help correct the problem, I'll do my best. With that, we will be here for Workplace Racism on Thursday. Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I had someone just literally seconds ago wrote me about Workplace Racism. So we're already getting prepped for that program. Friday, The Delectable Negro. It is our sixth study session. We are beyond the halfway point, the late Vincent Woodard's text. I'm going to see if we can get Dr. Tommy Curry. I'm going to see if he can give some background biographical information for Mr. Woodard so I can supplement our reading as we proceed with the text. We still have probably 2 or 3 weeks to go before we conclude, and then the compensatory call-in will be Saturday. So Thursday, Friday, Saturday, we'll be back for the remainder of the week. And again, if you have questions, guest suggestions, problem finding something in the archives, just drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Invest if you think the program is constructive, racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop an email. We will get you a physical mailing address, and my physical mailing address did change this month. So if you just make sure you drop an email to confirm that you have the accurate mailing address before mailing anything off to Gus. And my Amazon information is accurate for anybody who gets items off of our wish list. It is accurate, up to date, the address there. With that, we will be back on Thursday. This program, and again, to emphasize the victims in this case, these young black female scholars, they were sober. I cannot imagine their situation being improved if they had, you know, had a blunt before all this happened, or had a few drinks, had a glass of wine. I cannot imagine how that would have improved their situation. I think because they were sober, they did see that this was an issue, or were even bringing up that they, hey, racism is being practiced right now, because they were alert and had their brain computer functioning at a high level. So just to, again, we are under conditions of white terrorism. We want to make sure that we are paying attention, that we are super mindful about things that are happening around us. If there are whites in the area, even other victims of racism can be problems at times. So just to encourage that, I think Dr. Welsing, her name was mentioned. Dr. Ani knew about her work. Dr. Welsing, Mr. Fuller, Dr. Kanban, a lot of the folks that I think folks at least say that they revere would definitely support us being sober as a counter-racist tactic. I don't think we're going to be in a better position to neutralize Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any other race soldier under the influence. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.